Facebook went public in May 2012, it created 850 millionaires and was valued at $105 billion. The company recently announced plans to acquire WhatsApp, a five-year-old messaging app, for $19 billion. When Twitter went public in November, it created 1,600 new millionaires and was valued at $31 billion. Millions of people use these services, but we don't pay for them. So how are they worth so much money? On today's Your Call, we continue our week-long series on our hyper-connected world by focusing on the economic drivers of the digital world. How do these companies make so much money? And are they making this money, or is it on paper? And what would an alternative model look like? Join us after the news.
BBC News with David Austin. The Malaysian Air Force says radar information suggests a passenger airliner that went missing on Saturday changed course and headed west towards the Strait of Malacca. The Malaysia Airlines plane was travelling northeast from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing when it disappeared less than an hour into its flight. Jonathan Head is in Kuala Lumpur.
Some military sources are suggesting that it may have been tracked right the way back in the direction it came, across the Malaysian Peninsula, and right into the Straits of Malacca. That would explain why no wreckage has been found in the South China Sea. What's hard to explain is how the plane could do that undetected. It would have suggested that every single one of its communications equipment, all its transponders and emergency beacons, were switched off, and that therefore it was only military radar that spotted it. None of that's been explained yet, but it's a possibility they're looking into. And of course, the fact that they're directing quite a lot now of their assets, as they call them, the ships and planes, to the Straits of Malacca, suggests they're taking that possibility very seriously.
Libyan Prime Minister Ali Zeidan has been ousted by Parliament after a tanker laden with oil from a rebel-held port escaped to sea by breaking through a naval blockade. MPs called a vote of confidence in Mr. Zeidan after hearing that the tanker, sailing under a North Korean flag, had reached international waters. The oil had been bought from rebels in control of the port of El Sidra. The Libyan authorities threatened armed action to stop the vessel leaving. The head of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee has accused the CIA of engaging in possible criminal activity by spying on Congress. Dianne Feinstein said that the CIA had improperly searched the computers of congressional staff who were investigating allegations against the CIA. Regina Vaidyanathan reports from Washington.
In an explosive statement on the Senate floor, Dianne Feinstein set out what's become a very public rift. Her committee's currently investigating the CIA's use of torture during the Bush administration. Staffers were given access to computers containing millions of pages of secret CIA documents. She accuses the spy agency of accessing these files twice without authorization, as well as removing hundreds of documents without anyone knowing.
Michelle Bachelet has been sworn in as the president of Chile for the second time. In a highly symbolic ceremony, she promised to tackle social injustice by overhauling the education, healthcare and tax systems. Gideon Long reports from Santiago.
Mrs. Bachelet becomes the first democratically elected Chilean head of state in over half a century to return to the presidential palace for a second term in office. She'd already made history in 2006 as Chile's first female president. In an emotional ceremony in the Congress building, Isabel Allende, the first female head of the Chilean Senate, placed the red, white and blue presidential sash around Mrs. Bachelet's neck. It was the first time that one woman had passed the sash to another.
World News from the BBC. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the American Secretary of State John Kerry have held talks on the telephone about Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Ministry said Mr. Lavrov stated that any solution to the crisis must take into account the interests of all Ukrainians and that the right of Crimean residents to determine their future must be respected. Police and protesters have clashed in Turkey's two biggest cities after the death of a teenager who was wounded in last year's mass anti-government demonstrations. Police fired tear gas and water cannon in the capital Ankara to disperse students who'd blocked a highway. Several people were arrested outside the hospital in Istanbul, where the boy, Berkin Elvan, died. Selin Girit reports.
The news of 15-year-old Berkin Elvan's death was announced early this morning. "We lost our son. May he rest in peace," wrote his family on Twitter. As the news spread, people started gathering in front of the hospital where he spent 269 days in a coma. The police showed up, the crowd got angrier, and police intervened with pepper gas. Berkin's story had become a symbol for Gezi Park protesters. He was walking to buy bread when he got hit in the head by a tear gas canister.
A video showing a Nigerian man being brutally attacked by police in South Africa has provoked public outrage. The footage, which has had more than 200,000 views on social media, has led to the arrest of two police officers. In a statement to the BBC, the police confirmed that the officers involved were from the central headquarters in Cape Town. A collection of the world's oldest masks, dating back to the dawn of civilization, have gone on display in Jerusalem. The stone masks, which appear to have been modelled on skulls, have round holes for eyes, tiny noses, and prominent displays of teeth. Experts say they were made 9,000 years ago in the hills and deserts near Jerusalem. And those are the latest stories from BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The devices that connect us to the internet allow us to access a vast amount of content, and most of it is free. We can access Facebook for free by simply creating a profile, or use Google's search engine, use Twitter, or take and post Instagram photos, all free of charge. Now, even though these companies don't charge users any money, they are worth billions of dollars. In May 2012, Facebook closed its first day of public trading, valued at $105 billion. It was the largest internet IPO in history, and it created 850 new millionaires. In April of 2012, Facebook bought Instagram, a popular photo-sharing service with just 13 employees, for $1 billion in cash and stock. And then last month, Facebook paid a whopping $19 billion for WhatsApp. That's a five-year-old company that allows you to send messages to friends around the globe for free. When Twitter went public in November, it created 1,600 new millionaires and was valued at $31 billion. So how are these companies worth billions of dollars, even though they're not selling any products? Is advertising the most common way of generating revenue for these websites? Generating enough revenue? Is that where the money's coming from? How does it work, and what is the nature of online advertising? On today's Your Call, we continue our week-long series on how the digital revolution is changing our world by focusing on the forces behind the rapid growth of advertising and marketing. In the first half of 2013, internet ad revenue reached $20 billion. So what are the economic drivers of the digital world, and is the internet really free? Today we're joined by Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy at Free Press, an organization that advocates for universal and affordable internet access, diverse media ownership, vibrant public media, and quality journalism. Hi, Tim. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us. We're also joined by Jason Ben-Levy. He's a writer and creative director and author of the book, Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. And Jason joins me in studio. Hi, Jason.
Good to be here.
Nice to see you offline.
I know, really.
Great to have you. So, you know, it's kind of amazing when you read about how much these companies are, quote, worth and valued.
Right.
Facebook is valued, well, was in 2012 when it went public, at $105 billion. That's more than most Fortune 500 companies, most countries, and yet when you look at its profits, even though the headlines say Facebook profit soars, in the fourth quarter, its profits were $2.6 billion.
Right.
So how do you explain how these companies are worth so much money?
Well, they really have more to, the worth of these companies has more to do with the IPO than it does with the actual underlying reality. There's a lot of promise that goes into the marketplace and a lot of hype about these companies when they go into the marketplace. And only some of the shares of the company are ever sold. But what happens is that most companies that are startups start with venture capitalists. And venture capitalists will put some seed money in. And the main idea is that you put a few million dollars in here, a few million dollars in there, and join with some other people. But the objective isn't necessarily to build a company as it is to get to the next stage, which is to turn it into an initial public offering, which is what IPO stands for, which is when some of the shares of the company are sold to the public. Now, because not all of the shares are sold to the public, it creates a value based on a multiple of what that market price of the shares is. So when you go and say when the venture capitalists decided to go and turn Facebook public, A certain percentage of those shares was sold. It established a market price, and all the remaining shares are based on that price. So maybe 20% of the shares are ever in the public marketplace, but we can consider people billionaires because they hold stock that is a multiple of that number. But in terms of actually being able to generate money, most of these companies are much more promise than they are reality.
And you have major investment firms behind these IPOs. So, for example, Facebook's IPO was conducted by Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs.
Right. And so what they do is they leave the venture as soon as it gets started. So people like Peter Thiel and other venture capitalists will be in there until the day that the company goes public or the week that the company goes public, and then they clear out. So companies like Zynga, which is a really great example of a company that already has started to its downward slide, which was the hot gaming social gaming company, which we may or may not remember with Farmville and all of that. So when they went public at about $10 a share. The founders and the venture capital people cleared out rather quickly. And also they knew what the books really were, because when you go public, suddenly the books are public and people can find out whether you're making money or not.
So it created, in Facebook's case, created 850 new millionaires.
Right.
And then these banks also made a lot of money.
The banks make money on doing the transaction. So there's like the venture capitalists, the banks who do the transaction, and then there's people who are the inside holders. So there's money to be made on every part of this process. And you'll find a lot of the same names doing the initial public offerings that you found in the mortgage disaster of earlier in the decade.
Tim, what would you add to that? I mean, it's still kind of hard to understand how a company like Facebook, that doesn't sell anything, obviously makes money through ads, but not that much when you look at the fact that it's valued at $105 billion. How do you explain that?
Well, there's another piece of the financial puzzle here, and that is the business model that these companies use. There's a term that you may have heard called big data. These companies are really building their business around this notion that they will offer you services for free. Google will give you free search. Facebook provides you a social network for free, and they will accumulate millions upon millions. Facebook now claims it has more than a billion users who will provide them with personal data. And this big data business model is built on the idea that they will give you a service in exchange for tracking everything that you do online, and in some cases it even tracks what you do offline, or if you're working with a cell phone application, it can track where you go. And so they're accumulating multiple points of data about every individual that then could be tailored and sold to online advertisers. And many people, including me, would argue that that's a very vulnerable business model. We've seen in the last 9 months since Edward Snowden came forth and revealed how some of these businesses were working with governments to spy on individuals, that there are vulnerabilities there. And in fact, there are a lot of people out there who don't like that their data is being used this way and may at some point want to use other models for searching the Internet, those models that protect, or other models for Gmail or for social media, models that actually protect their privacy in ways that doesn't make it available to all of these advertisers and, in some cases, to the government.
Well, and we'll talk about alternative models also on today's show. I also wanted to ask you both about the acquisition of WhatsApp. So this is, it's got 35 employees. It's a five-year-old company. It allows you to send messages, photos, voice messages to anybody in the world free of charge. Facebook paid $19 billion for this company. That's $543 million per employee, bigger than the GDP of 80 countries. Jason, what was your reaction when you heard that Facebook spent $19 billion on this?
Other than it being an insane number for a service that is almost free, you have to ask yourself, what is the objective of doing that? And the reason why people wanted that service is that it was relatively private. It did not carry advertising and was cheaper than using SMS messaging on a phone. So for a lot of countries, it's not that big in the U.S., but in other countries where you pay a lot for SMS messaging, it's a great idea. But when once Facebook buys it, how does it fit into their universe? Does it become an advertising media? If it becomes an advertising media, it immediately goes and throws people out of it who purposely did not want to be tracked, purposely did not want ads put in their face as if it's spam on your phone. So how does it work in terms of a business model? It really doesn't, except for the fact that perhaps they think they're going to acquire more users in the process of doing it.
Because WhatsApp is used by 450 million people. That's huge.
Right. And they pay like a dollar a year or something like that. It depends on the local currency in order to participate in it, which is a great thing if you're a company of 50 people. That's a lot of money. But if you're trying to be a $19 billion company, that doesn't make any sense.
Tim, what's your thought on this acquisition?
Well, I can bring some anecdotal evidence that I actually think is true for a lot of folks. I have a preteen daughter who's just, you know, using social media, and she thinks Facebook is uncool because her father's on Facebook. But she loves Instagram, and she loves WhatsApp. And so in many ways, it's kind of Facebook's effort to capture the next big thing, to bring it into their universe so that as, you know, if in fact a younger population is moving to other types of social media, things that their parents aren't also doing, they also control that. So as companies like Facebook and Google and to some extent Yahoo are sort of building out their social media empire, they want to be able to corner the market in other applications, and WhatsApp is something that I've witnessed younger people are much more interested in, apparently, than posting photos to Facebook, which at one point we all thought was the new thing to do.
Right. But the problem with all of that, and especially when the numbers are that big on the purchase, is that the trends move fast. It doesn't take very long to develop a new app and publicize it in that kind of underground market, especially among young people, and then it's gone. And it's on to something else. And so that's why the valuations of these companies become kind of silly. Certainly something like WhatsApp could be wiped out by Apple just going making iChat public or messaging public since the technology's already there and cross it over into the phone world. So it's really kind of a really faux business model.
So when you're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, is the end goal here, I mean, are they going to make their money on mobile ads? Is apparently going to be the next big thing. It's already huge. They're going to send ads to your phone when
right.
you go through the services.
And usually location-based. So that's one of the more important things about that is that if you're near a restaurant, the restaurant will be able to pop up a special offer to you to go to that place. And it's basically location-aware advertising is the value of mobile. But at the same time, mobile ads aren't very compelling. And they certainly can feel like annoyances rather than a plus. So this might be another case of over-promising in terms of its viability as an advertising model.
What?
And bear in mind that you know data brokering is still a huge business. There are companies out there that we've never heard of
right.
that have amassed tons of data.
Right.
About our online habits and our offline habits that are accrued through, you know, putting cookies on our website, putting, you know, just trading data with some of the social media companies. That they build a mountain of data that boils down to personal profiles of hundreds of millions of people.
Right.
That is useful. Not only it is a useful business or a profitable business in its own right because they are selling that data not just to advertisers but to others out there who might want to learn more about the marketplace. So there is this whole industry that is in and of itself about collecting our data and selling it in ways that seem to be profitable.
Right. And they're profitable in terms of making merchants believe that they're productive. Because it's still somewhat, at this point, they're kind of choking on data, that a huge part of this business is really selling the software and selling the services to these other companies, to merchants, to make them believe that they're going to get some sort of extraordinary business advantage by having all of this. But as of yet, it's not really all that productive.
Well, we did a show about this Monday the 3rd with Julia Angwin about her book Dragnet Nation, and she was just talking about the fact that it's really cheap now to gather so much
right.
data for these companies.
Right.
But again, the question is, how are they going to turn around and turn that into these massive profits?
I don't think that it's going to be as massively profitable as they think it's going to be. Again, you can go and come up with a really tight profile of someone and send an ad to their phone, but that means that, you know, that they're not necessarily going to respond. The response rates, even on click-through on ads, is incredibly low. Certainly not a great model. I think the reason that Google has been relatively successful at advertising is that you are literally telling it what you're looking for, which is a far more equitable model. And also you're shown what is paid advertising and what isn't.
That is,
another thing is that there is a great deal of uncertainty in advertising and marketing at the moment. The traditional media, print, and broadcasts have seen their numbers plummet, certainly in the print side, more than any. And so we're in this sort of gray area, this area of uncertainty, where there is a massive marketing economy, billions of dollars spent to promote companies and products, that doesn't really know where to go. And
right.
you have now Google and Facebook presenting themselves as, they think, a viable option. So if you are, you know, rather than spending billions or hundreds of millions of dollars and millions of dollars on a full-page print campaign, you would look at taking a significant chunk of that money and putting it into the digital world, where
right.
all of these companies have presented themselves and they put themselves forth as a more effective and a better targeted way to get to your audience.
Right, but the one thing is that ad budgets don't automatically grow because there's more media to put it on. Which is part of the false promise of most of the social media companies and most of the ones that are ad-based, is that they expect that just because they're there that they're going to get ad revenue and that it's going to be enough to justify the value ratio of the company. And it's just not true. The ad budgets don't grow just because you've added another media.
Do we know if these services are turning us more into consumers than we already are? Because according to L2 research, Instagram users are overwhelmingly young, wealthy, and female. And again, Instagram is a popular photo sharing service. It was bought by Facebook for $1 billion in April 2012 with just 13 employees. And according to L2, it says most important for Instagram's future revenue potential are hundreds of the world's top brands like Gucci, Michael Kors, Macy's, Gap. They're going to generate a lot of interest, presumably sales from Instagram users. The end goal here is to accelerate our transformation from citizens to more consumer.
I'd say that's true.
Do you think it'll work?
Well, I think it works for a narrow band of things. I think that you can attract attention to your product, absolutely, through that kind of media, through that kind of user-generated media, which certainly has some impact. And then there's also just the kind of campaigns that also take place in that. But what we find is when we put too much advertising in any kind of media, we tend to find a way to get around it. So we have spam filters for dealing with our email not being what we wanted it to be. We have fast forward through our DVRs to skip the commercials. And so it's not necessarily going to be as productive, and it certainly doesn't justify the valuations of the companies.
That is Jason Ben-Levy. He is a writer and creative director and author of the book Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. We're also joined by Tim Carr, Senior Director of Strategy at Free Press, an organization that advocates for universal and affordable internet access, diverse media ownership, and quality journalism. And today on Your Call, we're continuing our week-long series on our hyper-connected world by talking about the economics of the tech sector. We're just talking about some of the big companies. Facebook, when they went public in May 2012, they were valued at $105 billion. They created 850 new millionaires. Twitter, when it went public in November, created 1,600 new millionaires and was valued at $31 billion, even though it's never turned a profit.
Right. By the time it went to the IPO, it had lost $500 million.
Wired had a great headline called Twitter's Big Day, Why Zero Profits Make for a Great IPO. So how do you explain that one?
Simply the perception that it is going to be big is enough to drive that slice of shares that go into the public marketplace that people are convinced is going to be the next new thing becomes the value in itself. So it's kind of chasing itself. And remember, we had At Home, remember at home, yeah. And Yahoo, which used to have this extraordinary valuation, and Netscape. And there's a lot of companies that have gone down this path that created a stir in terms of what it looked like it had as a valuation, but it was never there. The ratio of how much money they could bring in never justified it. But stock markets have a way of having people chasing things that have already happened, as opposed to things that are going to happen.
If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What are your questions about how the tech economy operates, and what are your thoughts about the value of these corporations, hundreds of billions of dollars? If you work in the tech industry, what do you think about how it operates and where its revenues are going to come from in the future? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if you have any creative ideas for alternative models, we'd also love to hear from you. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Also, the other thing is, in the 90s, when we saw the bubble burst, I mean, that was a huge deal. And right. A lot of people say that we're going to see another bubble. But the difference is, because I was a tech reporter back then,
right.
Focusing on privacy issues, is that you had a lot less money back then in a lot more hands.
Right.
And nowadays, you have a lot more money in fewer hands.
Right. I think there are by far fewer companies in the category that we saw back then. And also, it bled across the entire stock market back then. Right now, the only things that are really excessively valued are these social networking companies and new media companies, just simply because of the sparsity of the shares in the marketplace and also the amount of hype that went into the launch of them.
Do you think we're going to see a burst?
I think we'll see a burst on some companies, but it won't affect everything. Companies like LinkedIn are probably extremely overvalued. Twitter is probably extremely overvalued because they actually have to show some sort of profit ratio that justifies the price. And once there's a panic on something like this, it all just goes down. But it shouldn't affect everything the way it did at the end of the last century.
All right. Well, let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Something that you said and also that the guest said, a different thing, made me think of something. And you had said that you wondered since these companies aren't making money, why is everybody prepared to pay so much for their stock? And the guest said later on that the stock market actually, the values in the stock market often lag behind the realities of companies' performance. And that made me think this question. To what degree do people invest in things, not because necessarily they feel that they're going to keep going up, but just because they feel they're going to keep going up
right.
before they go down?
Right.
And therefore they say, I think this thing's going to collapse in 2 years. I'm just using that as an example. So I'm going to hold it for 1 year.
Hmm. Right. It's called momentum investing, actually. And it's kind of like you're trying to get on the ship while everybody is, but you think you're going to be the one who gets off. And often you wind up not being the one who gets off. You wind up with a bag full of nothing.
And a lot of people lost a lot of money in the 90s because
of
that.
I know many coworkers and collaborators who I work with who were millionaires and are now just back to being plain people working.
Tim, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, there's a concern about the overall integrity of the internet when you have these sort of massive evaluations and you have the potential for, you know, this bubble to burst and the market to crash. And there's a tendency here to look at internet users as mere consumers. And I think one of the miraculous things about the internet is one of the things that we work really hard on at Free Press is that the internet is also this incredible engine for free speech, for political organizing. It's given communities and people a voice that didn't have a voice before. And if we increasingly look at internet users of these internet-based companies, as merely consumers and not generators of their own media, people who have a voice in their own right, then it diminishes the importance of the internet as a sort of free speech infrastructure.
Right.
And I think when you have the companies like this create so much buzz and try to accumulate so much power over free speech and other things online, you have a host of other problems that can undermine the integrity of the internet itself.
Right. And in terms of that, certainly the net continues to go on. It never goes away. But it's still hard to keep the attention, the focus on some of the nonprofits.
Well, and hold that thought. And after the break, I'd love for you both to offer an example of when you think free speech was negatively affected because of this economic model that we're seeing and this obsession with so much money and the valuation of these companies. Today, we are continuing our week-long series on our hyper-connected world and on our agenda for a new economy. We're focusing on how the tech economy works and what explains this massive valuation of these companies that barely make a profit. We'll be back after this.
Yep. You're listening to Your Call here on KALW, local public radio. To join in today's conversation, the number to call is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We love to hear from new voices. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can always send us an email. Feedback@yourcallradio.org is the email address. Feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can simply leave a comment there at the website if you like, too. Your Call Radio. .org. Coming up at 11, live from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation about how the wireless world is affecting children's health. We touched on this briefly yesterday, but tomorrow Holly will elaborate on a lot of the questions that came up. Is it harmful for children's physiology and brain development? What is it doing to them emotionally? A lot of schools are embracing Wi-Fi. So how is that going to affect children? That's tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we will talk about how we can get value from these devices while minimizing the harm, minimizing everything from spending way too much time on them, potentially affecting our sleep, our eyesight, our relationships. Should this be a public health issue? That's on Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are continuing our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about how the tech economy works. And why is it that so many companies that don't turn a big profit are valued at, say, $105 billion in the case of Facebook? They created 850 new millionaires when they went public in May 2012. In April 2012, Facebook bought Instagram for $1 billion, recently paid $19 billion for WhatsApp, a five-year-old company that allows you to send messages to people around the globe for free. Twitter created 1,600 new millionaires when it went public in November and is valued at $31 billion, even though it's never turned a profit. So what questions do you have about the tech economy if you work in technology? What are your thoughts on how the economy works? Are there any better ways to do this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And if you use these services, what are your thoughts on the notion that they're actually free when they are grabbing so much of your personal information to turn around and sell it to turn a profit, or at least that's the hope? Today, we're joined by Tim Carr, Senior Director of Strategy at Free Press, an organization that advocates for affordable internet access and quality journalism. Jason Benlevy is author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. So before the break, you were both talking about how this economy and how the fact that these companies are worth so much money and have access to so much information negatively affect free speech and what the internet is supposed to stand for. Jason, do you have any examples?
Well, I think that it's more that we're establishing choke points for dialogue. So if and I know there's some recent examples where Facebook has decided that it didn't like the content that was moving over it and decided that it would filter that content. And if we've kind of agreed that Facebook is kind of the common ground, the public square for everybody, then we've got a problem. But I think that we need to, even though we like social, and social is really a good thing, and you and I both are active participants, that we have to move to a model that's not a commercial model. That much like we have email, which is not like AOL email was, which is that was filled up with spam and paid for. We need one that is open and not supported by being a business.
Well, so how do you do that? Because Robert McChesney talks about this a lot.
Right.
And he says that you might have some of these initially when young people start these companies, mostly guys, they're not big capitalists, right? They start this company with the idea you just described
right.
in mind.
Right.
And yet, once the company takes off and once they start to understand how the venture capital world works and how the IPO world works, they become hardcore capitalists.
Right. I think that because I live among most of these people, so I kind of hear the conversations. And it depends where in time you look at this. I'd say that after the crash, people were really interested in using the technologies for connections and building social structure. That's what it was, Web 2.0. It was kind of restarting it all and trying to find a way to get people to connect, and Friendster and all these kind of sharing applications came along. But then once the big IPOs started happening, the mindset of people developing these applications really changes. And if you listen to the conversations, everybody's talking about wanting to sell whatever it is they're inventing to either Facebook or to Twitter or to go public. And so it's really shifted the mindset. So we're moving away from the creative, I want to do something, to this, like, I want to be the next Zuckerberg.
So, Tim, how do you embrace a non-commercial model given the realities that we're facing?
Well, just first to comment on that, I think, people are familiar with the First Amendment. The First Amendment is a restriction, government action against free speech. And to use the analogy earlier that something like Facebook is a public square, it's not. It's more like if you wanted to, hold the protest in a private shopping mall, you may think you're in a public space, but you're not. And if you read the terms and conditions of these websites, you'll see it's very clear that they have every right to block your website, and they or block your post or block your communications, and they have in the past. And you even have extreme cases like Yahoo in China, which handed over information on a Chinese blogger who had been blogging against the government, who subsequently ended up in prison. So you have these kind of, we're in a sort of uncertain age where we are using these new media to communicate billions of people, and yet the sort of free speech protections that we may take for granted don't exist. But there's a growing backlash to that, which is why, to answer your question, we've seen the emergence of search engines that don't track you. For example, there's DuckDuckGo, which is a really small, certainly small when you compare it to Google, which is a search engine that doesn't track your search patterns, doesn't track where you go from their search engine to websites. So there are alternatives out there. There are also email services that offer encryption services after encryption so that they can't track who you're talking to, things like that. So there's a somewhat peripheral movement right now, which has gained some momentum in the wake of the Edward Snowden revelations to create these kind of non-commercial social media services, search services,
right,
email services that don't rely on big data. They don't rely on tracking your data so they can sell to advertisers.
Right, and actually the first models of doing email are not that. I mean, that it was only when people started going over to Gmail and Hotmail, which are actively searching your mail, that became part of the advertising media. But before that, we had, and we still do, if you have your own account on your own server, you don't have email that's being tracked.
And that's DuckDuckGo.com. Do you have any other examples of companies that are offering really good services that aren't as commercial?
Sure. There's an organization called RiseUp, RiseUp.net, that is providing a whole range of cloud-based services, shared documents that you can use in the cloud, communications, listserv services that is doing good work. And there's a whole range of them. There have been efforts both in the commercial and non-commercial realm. Some of these are supported by foundations and other forms of grants
right.
to build these kind of secure communications, online communications that don't rely upon this data tracking model, which is so tempting to governments and advertisers.
Any other examples, Jason?
No, actually, DuckDuckGo was going to be my first one-up, and I totally agree. DuckDuckGo is a great way to go. It's also a really good search engine, so you're not losing anything by going to DuckDuckGo.
And Tim, we did a show recently about the Comcast acquisition of Time Warner Cable, or the proposed acquisition. And you all focus on trying to fight for universal and affordable internet access. Can you talk about how some of the companies that actually deliver this information, what stands out for you about their economic models?
Well, increasingly it's a model that's based on two things. One's on scarcity, this idea that they can restrict your data. And the other one is on monopoly. A lot of, increasingly, our internet service provider, we've been talking mostly about what are called edge companies, companies that actually are built on the internet, but the service provider is the company that provides you with that connection so that you can go to Facebook or Google or hopefully to DuckDuckGo. But these internet service providers, the connection providers, exist in the United States in a marketplace that's not very competitive. And as a result of that, they've raised prices. The price of your basic cable services have risen double the rate of inflation over the past 17 years, and they've restricted your access. There are data capping models that companies like Comcast put in place that restrict your ability, once you go online, to use a lot of data, to watch videos or listen to music without paying an extra price. So you're seeing these choke points at internet access. You're also seeing the monopolization of access. So we don't have a lot of choices, and it's a problem when you see these mergers on the scale of the one that's proposed by Comcast.
Right.
The number one internet cable provider is proposing to buy the number two internet cable provider, Time Warner Cable, and create an even larger monopoly. So you have this kind of consolidation of the internet service industry, and I think in many ways, even when you're talking about the edge company, you're talking about what Facebook is doing in their acquisition plan and what Google is doing in their acquisition plan. You're also seeing a consolidation of edge companies. And when you have media consolidation in any field, it happened in radio and television and traditional cable, you have a problem where consumers get less choice and are forced to pay higher rates for access.
Right. And as a good example is people like to talk a lot about cable cutters right now going away from having TV packages, but they're totally dependent on the same company to deliver them the bandwidth in order to do that. So it's kind of you're really not cutting the cable.
And again, we're talking about a lot of money. This is
a $45 billion
acquisition.
Right. In addition to the fact that Comcast, as an example, also is a content company and can put its own content as a preferred channel over it and run with exclusive deals. If you want to have HBO as an example, in order to have that, you have to have the cable service of it in order to have it as a mobile service.
Right. And so, then we recently saw Netflix pay Comcast to ensure that the TV shows we watch through Netflix are streamed.
And that was the end of net neutrality is when that deal happened, because they paid extra in order to go and put their content on the web.
And reports now say that this basically shut Netflix up, because when Comcast goes in front of it, like if there's a hearing about this, Netflix will just say, we're out of it.
Right. Before it was the Silicon Valley billionaires versus the people who own the pipeline billionaires. And now if they can buy off more of the Valley billionaires, it becomes not a discussion anymore, other than us on one side and them on the other.
Well, you know, Netflix is now a very powerful company. And so what we should be concerned about is not so much the fate of Netflix, which can afford to pay these special carriage deals, but the fate of the next Netflix,
absolutely.
The next company that has a great idea about how people can experience video over the internet, will now be big-footed out because they have to broker a deal with an internet service provider
and Hulu
like Comcast or AT&T. Or Verizon, they can't afford it because Netflix has already dominated the space.
Right, and Hulu, as an example, is owned by the major networks. It's a conglomeration of major networks.
And Hulu is
another video service,
Well, and the thing about Netflix is they actually have monthly subscriber fees coming in. They've got 50 million subscribers, 50 million in profit at the end of the first quarter in 2014.
Right. Even though their stock is somewhat at an exaggerated point as well at the moment. So.
Even though they've got people sending them checks every month.
Right. Even though
unlike the other ones.
Right. Unlike the other ones. They have a great income, but their stock is also excessively valuated.
That is Jason Tim, go ahead.
I'm sorry. And one of you know, one of the things that we see in any media, you look at the history of media, and if you look at radio, if you look at television, and you look at cable, there's a period at the very beginning. In the very beginning of radio, it was a very diverse medium. There were a lot of people who were starting stations, and you know, it was there was a lot of experimentation. But over a cycle of years, you saw this consolidation of the industry, where fewer and fewer players, corporate players, get control, to the point where you had RCA, for example, controlling a lot of radio stations. And fast forward, you had you had Clear Channel owning a lot of radio stations. And it, the same thing has happened in television, where we're seeing the consolidation of local broadcasters. And we're kind of seeing that phenomenon again with the Internet, where you're getting consolidation. Powerful companies are rising up to dominate the space and to try to create these sort of monopolies over the various services that they provide. And this is what makes it so interesting, is that the Internet itself was not meant to be that way. The Internet is this kind of decentralized network. It's a network of networks where everybody can get online, and in theory we can choose what we do and where we go. It's a very overturned model of what media is supposed to be like. So we have this real central conflict going on, whether or not it's going to be consumers, users of the Internet, who control the fate of their media, or whether these large companies that are acquiring others and, you know, increasing their valuations and dominating their respective markets will ultimately get to decide where we go and what we do online.
And actually, with the Internet, we actually started with a lot of independent ISPs as our service. And then they became more consolidated and bought up. They were, again, small startup companies that would get bought by larger companies, until we wind up with maybe seven companies controlling the Internet at this point. Even though I'd have to say, if you live in San Francisco, you do have an alternative to Comcast and AT&T, which is a little company called Monkey Brains, which sends out your ISP service is over a little microwave dish that you put in your house, and they're local. They are literally a mile from here.
Do you use them?
Yeah, I do.
How's the service?
Excellent.
Just Monkey
excellent.
Brains.
Monkey Brains.
Okay. We talked about alternatives last time around, and SonicNet came up, a couple others.
Yep.
Do you have?
There are still a few around.
A few more. Okay. So Monkey Brains, SonicNet, we mentioned RiseUp.net, search DuckDuckGo.com.
DuckDuckGo, right.
We'll put these links on our website right after the show. That is Jason Ben-Levy. He's author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. He's creative director and a writer. And Tim Carr is senior director of strategy at Free Press, an organization that advocates for quality journalism, diverse media ownership, and affordable Internet access. Oh, so how much is Monkey Brains compared
to
Comcast?
It's $35 a month for someplace around 35 megabytes.
So pretty fast.
Oh, very fast.
Huh.
Very
All right.
fast.
Thank you for that.
The only thing it requires is a line of sight to one of their transmitters, but they're building more all the time.
So is it just in San Francisco?
I don't know. I think that maybe they may go beyond San Francisco, but right now they're local.
Okay. Thank you for that.
And there are a number of municipalities with, you know, mixed measures of success that are also trying to create their own community broadband networks, whether they're using these sort of Wi-Fi mesh networks, knitting together a Wi-Fi signal so people can get online, or whether they're actually installing fiber to the home. And there have been some successful examples.
Right.
Chattanooga, Tennessee has a really good story to tell.
Right. And actually,
there are ways that municipalities can get into this as well and say, you know, this Internet is important infrastructure. It is not simply a business model. It is something that people need to educate themselves, to participate in civic affairs, to be a part of the, you know, modern world. Therefore, we will provide it as a public service.
Right. And if we think about the Internet as one of the most important utilities we have, we certainly should follow the model that cities have followed by having a water service and sewer service, that we need to have this as a municipal thing. But the problem we have is that Comcast has such enormous lobbying power at this point, partly by buying up, by contributing to nonprofits that go and testify before Congress and in their favor.
And Politico just had an article about how, this is not surprising, but they're giving to Democrats and Republicans.
Yes, yes.
And it looks like Monkey Brains is only available in San Francisco. Another listener recommends LMI as an alternative ISP. So thank you for that. And you can give us a call if you'd like to join us today, talking about the tech economy, how it works, if you have any questions about how these companies are valued at $105 billion in the case of Facebook, or $31 billion in the case of Twitter, even though they haven't turned a profit, and they created 1,600 new millionaires when they went public in November. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you work for any of these companies, what are your thoughts about the future of their economies? Is it online ad revenue? Is that the future? And what are some alternatives? And then if you know of any alternative companies like this search engine that doesn't track you, DuckDuckGo, and all companies that embrace the non-commercial model, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255, or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Prasina in Milpitas. Hi, Prasina. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for this show. Very informative. Excellent points by both your guests as well. I'll just make a couple of comments, and I'll take your guest's comment off air. One is, of course, the acquisition of WhatsApp by Facebook. I think, well, not to belittle the CEOs of WhatsApp, but I believe it's a slap in the face of many other industries which actually put so much capital into building a company. The amount of capital that WhatsApp would have put in is probably minuscule compared to, say, for example, a semiconductor industry where every tape-out would cost them millions of dollars to create a product. It's not even clear what WhatsApp's revenue model is. It's very hazy in the first place. That's one thing. Second thing is, of course, I think one of your guests brought up a very good point about Google versus Facebook. Google obviously knows what you're looking for, but Facebook is constantly trying to predict what the users want. So I always worry about what they already have so much of data already in place, and my concern obviously is that their investors are probably going to arm twist them into using the data that they already have in ways that you and I may not like. I mean, just users of social media. So I don't quite know where it is going, because, like what you mentioned, both Facebook, Twitter, and many other social outlets just don't have a revenue model. It's very hazy, but they have a lot of data in their hands. And I don't quite know what they're going to do with it.
Prasina, do you work in the tech industry?
Yes, I work in a semiconductor industry, and that's one of the reasons why I brought that example up.
Okay. And so what do your colleagues and friends say about these issues?
Well, they are equally concerned, because I know a few of my friends who do want to get into to starting a company, but it may be based on semiconductor. But they already know that they are behind these companies like, say, WhatsApp and many of the social media, where the capital is much, much lower. So if they have to go talk to venture capitalists, they are more likely to invest in those companies than companies based on semiconductor.
Right. And actually, this is really interesting, because I find myself in a lot of discussions with people talking about tech workers in San Francisco, and I don't consider many of these people to be tech workers. Most of them are working at social networking companies, writing a couple lines of code here and there,
doing some
design. There is very little science involved and technology involved in what they're doing. And also, if you think about a number like $19 billion, what would it cost to build high-speed rail between Los Angeles and San Francisco? and you know that none of the trains are actually, that for any high-speed rail system or any transit system in the United States, are actually made in the U.S., because we don't have the investment in the plant and the technology to do that.
What are your thoughts, Tim, on Prasina's comment about WhatsApp? Again, Facebook bought WhatsApp for $19 billion. This is a five-year-old company that allows you to send messages to friends around the globe.
Well, you know, this is one of those Silicon Valley success stories that go down in the lore of Silicon Valley, and I think what you'll see then is a lot of other people trying to come up with ideas and approaching venture capitalists in Silicon Valley and saying, we're the next WhatsApp. And I think that's the kind of thing that happens a lot. I can remember, you know, when Microsoft bought Hotmail many, many years ago. I think they paid $450 million. And everybody fell out of their seats, but it created this kind of speculative bubble that could ultimately be pretty dangerous for the industry.
and actually, you know, it really started, the foundation of all this really is Netscape, which was a company that brought what was a publicly created web browser from a university and made it a commercial product. but never had any plan to make money at all other than selling the stock. And Mark Andreessen, who was the child, the 24-year-old behind that, is now a venture capitalist funding a lot of these other companies that also don't make money except for the people who are funding it in the IPO.
Well, thank you again for calling in, Prasenna. Let's go next to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill.
Hi. WhatsApp, it kind of amazes me. They're servicing 500 million people, and they were a, I don't know how many people start the company, whatever, 30.
It's about 50 people, I think, in the company.
People?
Yeah, something like that.
And so how were they able to, you know, are the costs for servicing that many people extremely low? You would think you would require billions and billions of capital for servers and whatnot.
Most companies don't even own their own servers anymore. That because computing has gotten so cheap and there's so many what people will call cloud services but are actually just data centers, they just rent the space to go and do that. So many companies that you know of are actually coming from servers that might be owned by Amazon, as an example. So you might be thinking you're interacting with Facebook, but you might actually be using an Amazon server. Yeah. Certainly, they again, the price of computing has gotten so cheap.
Well,
Facebook, I think they owned all their servers.
They might.
Thing. And so now, will they have to, will they be contracting out with another company? Since they, as what WhatsApp did,
I have no idea what the model will be, but that's a lot of capacity.
Yeah, and I'm sure, Bill, if you search online, you can probably find that. And WhatsApp has 55 employees, so thank you for calling. We have about a minute and a half left. We're seeing a lot more tech companies move into San Francisco downtown. It seems like this is just getting bigger. Where do you see this going, Jason?
Well, I think the balloon's going to inflate a little bit longer until at some point these companies are going to be held accountable for not actually making money. There's certainly what we all call startup companies out there, but startup means you got to actually go to the next phase. And whether many of these companies will go to the next phase, if they have anything of value at all, is something that we'll have to see. And that's the part that looks like 1999.
Tim, where do you think this is going?
Well, you know, I was in San Francisco last week at the RightsCon conference, and I had a chance to ask people from Facebook, Google, and Twitter whether they thought that, or whether they were thinking about a business model beyond big data. Could they envision a time where companies could make money not from trading on our personal data? And not very encouraging response.
I was going to say, what does the conversation sound like between you from Free Press and companies like Twitter and Facebook?
Well, you know, we share a lot of the same ideas about how the internet, you know, poses this fairly revolutionary medium that empowers people in many ways. But when it comes to the solutions, we seem to be on a different page.
So they do believe that the future is in selling personal information.
It's a big part of their business model. They are not willing to break from the big data model and think about, you know, a DuckDuckGo type of operation that could in itself, you know, be a viable business.
And just quickly, Jason, 30 seconds, how much power do citizens have, the citizens that are using these products?
You know, the one great thing about the internet is you're always a click away from changing vendors and changing what services you use.
Does that really matter?
It does, you know, because companies go away when people stop clicking at them. Just think about MySpace.
Jason Ben-Levy is author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech, and Tim Carr is Senior Director of Strategy at Free Press, an organization that advocates for diverse media ownership and quality journalism. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How are digital devices affecting children's health? On the next Your Call, we continue our week-long series on our hyper-connected world by focusing on children. In 2012, the American Academy of Pediatricians called on the FCC to conduct a formal inquiry into radiation standards for cell phones and other wireless products because standards have been based on the impact of exposure on an adult male. So what do we know about how devices affect the development of children? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
My name is Taylor Wilson. I'm 15 years old.
I am Mallory Wilson, and I'm speaking with my older sister, Taylor.
My name is Carlo Mosqueda.
My name is Eddie Randolph Wright.
I'm Robert McLean, age 81.
I'm Francesca McLean McCrossan. We're in San Francisco, and I'm here with my dad.
Who do you want to hear from? I'm Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps. We're recording stories from the Bay Area and archiving them at the Library of Congress. And we want to include yours. Come make history by recording a conversation at our booth, now located at the San Francisco Public Library. Visit StoryCorps.org for more information and make your reservation at 1-800-850-4406. Interview someone important to you today. And to hear stories from your community, stay tuned to 91.7 FM KALW.
This is KALW San Francisco. It's 11 o'clock.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. Today, the latest on Crimea and the missing Malaysian airplane.
It's probably one of the largest search and rescue operations. But what was sombering for me is that the large and massive area that we need to cover.
Still no debris, still no closure. We'll get the latest on the expanded search operation and hear from aviation journalists on the latest developments. Also in the program, with Russia's blessing, Crimea's rogue parliament seeks to declare itself an independent state if voters say yes to Russia in Sunday's referendum. And what does your country's flag mean to you? In New Zealand, calls to scrap its British-centric one and forge a more unique national identity. Tweet us live for the next hour. Our hashtag is WHYS.